I'm not in your way, am I?
I know the feeling.
Hey, well, Lorenzo is here, so we can start. That's the... I am particularly pleased to have Brendan here. Brendan was my PhD student, and if you get me privately, I can tell you all the things that he did when he was a graduate student. Which were not all mathematics. But you were at some point head of the graduate student union.
First, the GSA. Yes, that's right. I see it still exists, actually. We founded it with some of the graduate students back in 90... It still exists, yeah.
So, yes, he's a man of many interests. And anyway, I'm extremely curious as to how this series of talks is going to come out, because I understand it gets into form of manifold topology by the end. And starts with a very classical conjecture. So the first talk is going to be an overview of proof of Cartesian conjecture. And of course, you will tell us all what it is.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to give an extended talk, or series of talks, on this conjecture. So I'll talk a little bit about the plan of what I'm hoping to do, as Karen has said. For this talk, I'll give an overview or a summary of the conjecture and the proof, which myself, together with Wilhelm Klingenberg, have developed. I guess we'll probably put the date about 2008 at this stage, with some additions since then. Now, the Cartesian conjecture, I suppose there's many things you could say about the Cartesian conjecture. I mean, it was probably better known to a previous generation of geometers. Just to say exactly what it is. So the conjecture is as follows. It dates from about the 1920s. There's nowhere in writing. Karathiodori was a Greek analyst. In fact, there's nowhere in writing where he actually put it down, but it was first attributed to him in the 20s at a meeting of the Berlin Mathematical Association. And what it states is the following, is that so every closed convex surface in Euclidean R3 must contain at least two umbilic points. Now I'll explain roughly what these things, well, in detail, what all these things are. The smoothness, whether you look at this from the point of view of a smooth convex surface or what the differentiability of the surface is, was never initially stated. I guess you could define it, if it's C2 smooth is enough, is probably the lowest level of differentiability that you would, for which you can define what you mean by an umbilic point. However, the theorem, as I say, with myself and Wilhelm Klingenberg, states that this is this holds. Let me introduce S here for the name of that surface. Holds for S C3 plus alpha smooth. So certainly for a smooth surface, it's true, and you can drop the differentiability to just this Hölder space, so C3. Now this will come out from the method. It's probably not sharp, but certainly. It really comes from the method as to why we get this level of differentiability. Now, what I'm going to do with this talk, it's a classical, I mean, obviously it's a conjecture in classical surface theory. It has an interesting history, which I won't go through, because we actually don't use really anything from what has ever been published, little as it has been, on this in our proof. It's probably not a great conjecture in the sense that it hasn't up to this led to any very interesting mathematics, and there's, although it's probably fair to say that more people have worked on it than ever published anything to do with it. It's something that has been passed around, if you like. It's easy to state. It's totally unclear why it's true. It might be considered something of a sadistic problem that a supervisor could give to a graduate student, and it has been the case, I think, in the past that has actually occurred. It has also been the subject of false proofs. The first false proof was the International Congress in 1928 when Stefan Cohn-Vossen announced a proof of this conjecture, but his paper, he discovered a mistake at some stage and the paper was never submitted at the International Congress. What I'm going to do when in the next few talks, well, obviously, I said here, I'm just going to give an overview. And you'll see the main elements in the proof really are bringing together two or three different areas of contemporary mathematics. One would be parabolic flows. The other would be kind of global analysis with using holomorphic curves. And the third element, which is probably less familiar even, is this neutral Kähler geometry. In fact, that's the setting in which our proof takes place. So the second talk, I'll talk about the geometric aspects, our geometric setting, I guess, which is unfamiliar in some way. So in particular, I'll explain exactly what this is later in this talk. So neutral Kähler geometry. And we have some analytic aspects. So we have kind of the global analysis end of it. And we also have this mean curvature flow aspect of the proof. So the more analytic aspect of it I'll talk about in the second or third talk. And finally, I'll talk about a kind of a sharpening or an extension of the proof from this, what I'll call the global, right? Here we have a closed surface here, and there's also, you can prove it, and the historical method to attempt to prove this, as I'll show you in a minute, is to go from a kind of stronger local statement and then imply the global. But in fact, our proof goes precisely the opposite direction. And having established this global theorem, we will I'll show you how this comes up, gives you a local index bound on umbilic points. And what that does is it opens up a whole interesting dichotomy in three manifolds, or surfaces in R3, just taking it very simply, between real analytic surfaces and smooth surfaces, which is the ones that we're dealing with here. Okay, so this is what I hope to do over the next four lectures. So let me just back up and come back to the statement here. So, of course, to anyone basic background classical surface theory, your umbilic points are defined as follows. So if you have a surface, again, S sitting in R3, well, then we have the second fundamental form. So second fundamental form. Okay, I'll call it K, which is a 2x2 symmetric matrix. In fact, at a point, let's just take it as a point, K is really just the Hessian. So if you write, so you take your convex surface and you write it as a graph over the xy plane, say with the map F, well then this is just the Hessian. The second derivative in the x direction, dx, dy, dy dx, of course, being equal to the second derivative of y. So this is your Hessian, just at a point. But certainly it's a symmetric 2x2 matrix. 2x2 matrix. And as such, we can diagonalize it. And the objects of classical lambda 1, lambda 2, of course. Objects of classical surface theory, lambda 1, lambda 2, are referred to as the principal curvatures. Lambda I, principal curvatures. The eigendirections, EI, say I call them, will be the principal foliation. They give you a foliation of the surface at points. So this is the principal foliation. And when we look at this, of course, the classical objects of study would be your Gauss curvature, which would be your product of your eigenvalues. You would have the mean curvature, which is, of course, your average. And what we're interested in here, which is umbilic points, So a point P on S is umbilic if the two eigenvalues are equal at that point. So this is what we mean by an umbilic point. So umbilic, I guess in German they call it Nabelpunkt, navel point. So it's kind of a spherical point on your surface where it curves equally in all directions. Now, if you have, in general, if you take a surface in R3 and you look at it, you'll find that the umbilic points, if generically, will be isolated points. So if you have an isolated umbilic, we can define its index, the index of an isolated umbilic point, which I'll denote by I of P, which is the winding number of the principal foliation. So the winding number of the principal foliation. So the lines of curvature that come from the eigendirections in a neighborhood. So principal foliation. Interesting, this is not an integer. In fact, it's a half integer. Because the principal foliation, it just gives you a line field, doesn't give you its eigendirections really rather than eigenvectors. And so, in fact, you can have a non-orientable, I'll show you an example in a second, you can have a non-orientable foliation. So it's an element of 0, 2. So your index is a half integer. Okay, so let me just do one or two quick examples. So the simplest and probably the most pertinent one would be to look at what's called the triaxial ellipsoid. So if you look at the triaxial ellipsoid, where A is bigger than B, is bigger than C, say, you have a closed convex surface. I'm not going to be very good at drawing it, but in any event, you have four umbilic points, two on the top, if I was trying to draw this. You'd have two underneath, and your principal foliation looks like this. In fact, of course, you have a pair of foliations, right, that are orthogonal because your eigendirections give you two directions. So here would be one set and the other would be, they kind of look like this. So this is, for the ellipsoid, I don't know, this goes back a couple hundred years to the discovery of these lines of curvature on a triaxial ellipsoid. And the index, of course, is a half. So here's an example of a non-orientable foliation of your principal given by your lines of curvature or your principal foliation. So a half, and you have another a half and half in at the back there underneath that you wouldn't see. Now, if you let A go to B, so that's obviously what's called the triaxial ellipsoid. So if you make A equal to B, what happens is essentially two of the umbilics on the top and two on the bottom will come together, and you'll end up with kind of an egg shape with your lines of curvature. There'll be one set, and then, of course, you have another set there, and then your index will be 1 and 1. Of course, the sum of the indices, I guess I could have mentioned that earlier, the sum over, if you have all isolated umbilics, which is the generic situation, if you sum over your closed surface the index, you'll get the Euler characteristic of the sphere, which is 2. Okay, so here you have half, 1 half, 1 and 1. And so one way, certainly, that you can interpret this conjecture of Carathéodory is that you can't continue this process and coalesce these two umbilic points together. Right? They're very far away from each other when you get to this point, and if you want to try and bring them together to get a dipole, say an index 2 umbilic, something goes wrong. That you get some loss of differentiability. Of course, you can do it non-smoothly. I mean, you can take a closed convex surface and give it a little pinch point at one point and have it with no umbilic points anywhere. So with loss of differentiability, you can certainly bring them together and get rid of them in some sense. However, it's this subtle kind of aspect of it, this global aspect of it, that makes it a little bit hard to work out why on earth it's not possible to take that one step further and bring the two together. In fact, it becomes a little bit more tricky when you realize that you can easily construct examples. So there exists easy examples of closed convex surfaces. Smooth surfaces where these umbilic points are brought arbitrarily close together. So you can bring them arbitrarily close together, but somehow you can't just make them coalesce without somehow the surface losing some degree of differentiability. So there exist closed convex smooth surfaces with arbitrarily close.
Just Does convex mean it bounds something convex?
So there I just mean the K is, I should say, probably strictly convex. Convex would just be that I'll assume that that's strictly greater than zero. That would be the... But convex also in that any two points on the surface can be joined by a line inside. Right, same thing. Okay, so with arbitrarily close umbilic points. So one of the difficulties, say, of this conjecture is why is it true? I mean, what kind of methods, what kind of ideas would you need to solve this? Well, the question is, where does this even lie? Is this a question of topology? Is it a question of geometry? Or is it a question of analysis? I mean, what precisely is it that's obstructing you from bringing these things together when you can bring them arbitrarily close together very easily? So the idea, I guess, historically, not much has been... no progress really has been made on this conjecture as we have it there, or very little, I should say. But the traditional approach, if we might give it that, would be to replace this global statement, as I would call it, by a local index bound. So let me state what is... So this is a theorem of Hans Hamburger, an analyst... from the 40s and 41, I think it is. There's a series of papers. Now, they're quite long, and I guess there are some questions over. It's no mistake has ever been found in Hamburger, but the claim is that if your surface is real analytic, well, then he used methods of resolution of singularities in power series to show the index of an umbilic point must be less than or equal to 1. So P here is umbilic. Obviously isolated umbilic. Okay, now clearly that shows, because the sum of your indices must be 2, clearly this implies the global. Okay, so this is... So your corollary is this implies the Carrier theory or conjecture for real analytic surfaces. Now, I mean, I'd say this result has been, is probably the main concrete result that you could say has attempted directly to attack the conjecture, although, as I say, it's through this local version. Attempts have been made to simplify this proof that have, you could write down a whole list of them from the 50s, 60s, 70s, where people have attempted to improve this proof. Unfortunately, some of them introduced errors into it and then were subsequently fixed, and then these errors... so that you can find papers right up to 2008, I think, in which, again, Hamburger's proof is attempted to be done using, well, some modifications of the ideas he used. Now, I guess, let me... I don't have to say anything really about this except... what we do is we reverse this historical trend where an attempt to prove the global comes from this local by looking at the global one. And in any of these old conjectures, you probably need to have some significant new idea, and you also have to say, well, why is it true? So let me talk a little bit about why this statement is true. So this is myself with Wilhelm. Okay, so why is it true? What's at the back is the conjecture true? And you can give...
What's the picture where the index is bigger than 1?
You could get a local index bound of 3 over 2 and still have the global one not violated. So there's a little bit of extra space, you might notice here, between 3 over 2. And so you can take any... So 3 over 2, what would a 3 over 2 look like? Well, a dipole would look like... Right, so that's index 2. It's an index 2 foliation. Now, the question is, can that arise as the lines of curvature of an embedded smooth surface in R3? That's the question that we're trying to address. You can draw down, you can draw, you know...
this might be true without the real analytic, or it is.
Okay, so you can construct smooth examples, real analytic examples, up to and including 1. You can certainly, you can easily write down surfaces whose. In fact, some would argue that the reason that Carl Theodori came up with this conjecture is because he could construct ones up to index one, and they're very quite easy to do, and then it gets absolutely impossible. So no one could construct any examples, and it may have been something that simple that led him to make this conjecture. But again, you can draw foliations of any index, but the question is whether they arise as the lines of curvature of an embedding of a surface in a convex surface in R3, smooth convex surface in R3.
Yeah.
It's a theorem. I'm writing it as a theorem. It's stated as a theorem, and I guess most people believe the proof was. But the proof is unsatisfactory in some ways. But again, for what we do, it makes absolutely no difference because we don't do the real analytic case, we don't even do the local case, so we manage to elide getting into any discussion whether Hamburger is correct or incorrect in some way, just from our own point of view. But certainly no mistake has ever been found in Hamburger. The difficulty is that other people who have attempted to simplify the proof have introduced mistakes at various stages, and so it's gotten a little bit messy. You know, that's I guess, the bottom line. Okay, when you come back here, it was Hamburger who announced, who introduced, he knew the conjecture in the 20s. And in the 20s, I guess, this idea of an index, Hopf and Poincaré had just introduced in the previous becoming, so this was why Hamburger back in the 20s was already aware of this approach to proving this global theorem using this local. As to why in the 40s, I'm not exactly sure where.
He was German.
In fact, he was German, and he was in Cologne, and he had to leave before the Second World War, and he was in Southampton, I believe, in England. And then he took his chair back after the war, in fact, in Cologne. So he was in the University of Cologne, as far as I'm aware. Okay, so let me come back. So as I say, one of the difficulties with the conjecture is when you try and work on it, it's very hard to see why the hell it's true. And you try and look at this kind of local version of it, you end up fighting with power series, and you end up with these kind of chains of resolutions of singularities up through the power. And you don't get any sense as to why this conjecture would be true. So let me just give you the two aspects of this of our proof, which kind of explain in some sense what the main kind of philosophy as to why this conjecture would be true. The first thing is accident of low dimensions. Now, one could argue that most deep mathematics comes from such accidents of low dimensions, so maybe that's a little bit of a tautology if you believe this. Well, you know, it's difficult whether it is proof, whether it's deep. An accident of low dimension, which I'll be very specific about in a little bit as to why that is, and the other is the size of the Euclidean group. So these are the two kind of key factors philosophically as to why this conjecture is true, size of the Euclidean group. Okay, and that both of these I'll show you exactly where they come into the proof as we go along. Now, let me now give you just a three-step. How does our proof go? Just a quick summary of our proof, and then I'll come back and I'll fill in a little bit more of the details, and then by the end of this 1 hour, we'll certainly have had a quick run through and you can see a little bit of the ideas. I won't go into any of the details, and I'll fudge on some of the tricky questions, and I'll put them down to the next few talks to give them in more detail. So how does our proof go? So the proof really has, let's say, the main steps or the main guiding steps of our proof. So the main steps, the first one is that we reformulate the problem completely. So we reformulate the problem in terms of geometric properties. Properties of surfaces in TS2. So the total space of the tangent bundle to the two-sphere, which is a four-manifold. This is where we do all our work, in fact. So this is the connection between three-manifold and four-manifolds that Karen mentioned earlier. So I'll go through that in a minute. And in fact, in some ways...
Given if you're going to have four days of proof, it seems like a little more time, but, you know, who cares? Is there anything like this in Higher Dimensions? I mean, you can at least talk about this.
Yeah, you can talk about Hessian, and then I guess you could talk about semi-umbilics, because you'll have three, say, you know, you would have, if it's a hypersurface, if you're talking about a hypersurface in a higher dimension manifold, then you could ask, you could have two of the umbilics, yes, yeah, and your foliate, etc. So
there's no index thing or... Like,
yeah, exactly. You could strain the analogy and you could possibly find, but it's become a lot weaker and it's hard to see how you could even state something that would be equivalent in that way. So the accident of low dimensions is that this is kind of the dimension you can define it in, first of all, in natural way, and higher dimensional generalizations are possible. I'm not saying they're not possible, but you might be straining the analogy in that regard. But also our method of proof certainly would not work. That's quite clear, that the method of proof and why wouldn't work, or at least would have to be changed radically if we were to do that. So again, it's going to be dimensional dependent in a very, very strict way. And some of it is this. The fact is that we have this geometric correspondence between surfaces in R3 and surfaces in TS2. Now, why TS2, I'll explain in a minute, but essentially we leave R3 altogether. All of our stuff that I mentioned, mean curvature flow, etc., do not happen in R3. They really happen in this 4-manifold. But somehow the geometry is completely reflected in these two, equivalent in these two settings, and you can you prove the conjecture entirely in TS2 and then just translate it directly back into R3. Okay, so that's the first part of it. So what you do is you start out with a closed convex surface in R3 and you end up with a surface, a closed sphere in TS2. So let's call this sigma, just so I can have I'll try and be consistent with my notation. So you get a surface in TS2. And then the second part is to consider the Riemann-Hilbert problem. So consider the Riemann-Hilbert problem. So I'll explain what that is in a second. Hilbert problem. With sigma as the boundary condition. So we use this as the boundary condition for an elliptic PDE. And this is... right. So in other words, what we're looking for, so let me say what we're looking for. We're looking for a map F from the disk into TS2, whose boundary lies on this surface that you get from this reformulation, which I'll talk about in a second. So when you look at that, you want to say, well, what is it you want? Well, you want F to be holomorphic, so that with respect to it. Now, holomorphic with respect to what? I've said geometric properties, so there must be some geometry in TS2 that allows it, has to be a complex structure, so we can talk about holomorphic curves, etc. So what we do is we consider this Riemann-Hilbert problem. We take this surface in TS2 and we say, well, when can you detach a holomorphic disk whose boundary lies on this surface? That's a classical, it's an elliptic. This is an elliptic boundary value problem. Classical elliptic boundary value problem. And what we show is that if your surface, if the original surface S has only one umbilic point, so it would be a counterexample to the conjecture. So if S has only one umbilic point, then coming back to this, you get this sigma and look at this parabolic elliptic boundary value problem, then the linearization of this problem at a solution, again, these are details that I'll have to put in, is Fredholm regular. So by which I mean the co-kernel is zero. So co-kernel of the linearization is zero. It's empty. Okay, so this is from standard elliptic theory, but we use it specifically for this boundary value problem where we use this, what would be a putative counterexample to the Carathéodory conjecture, and we show that the co-kernel would be zero in such a circumstance. Okay, so I'm alighting some of the subtleties of the argument just to give you the main thrust of it. And then on the other hand, what we show by mean curvature flow is that the co-kernel is never zero. So therefore, such a putative counterexample does not exist. So the third part, by mean curvature flow in TS2, so in this 4-manifold, we construct or show existence of holomorphic disks in situations, precisely this kind of situation, and this implies that the co-kernel of this, we construct holomorphic disks, in fact, so that this co-kernel is never zero. It's never empty. And it's this contradiction that tells you that you can't have one that has an umbilic point, a single umbilic point. Now, the way to think about it is many ways. I mean, you can think of it, you start with a putative counterexample and then show it has contradictory properties. That would be one way to do it. Another way to do it is if you try and start pushing these umbilic points together, there's something stopping them from going together. And what is it that's stopping them? It's the co-kernel of this Riemann-Hilbert problem. It's the co-kernel of the Delbar operator. Somehow it doesn't want them to come together because you have co-kernel, and if you could get them together, there would be no co-kernel. So this is the kind of resistance that you see in this problem to bringing the umbilic points together. Okay, so you can see that really, if you look back at hamburgers, the idea of real analyticity and doing this locally, here this really is a global analysis result. You know, this is the global analysis, and then we use this PDE, this mean curvature flow in this slightly unusual setting, to show that between the two of them, you could never have a surface with a single umbilic point on it. Okay, so in what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go through those three steps, and I'll just fill in a little bit more of the detail as we go. I'll explain exactly what this reformulation is. I'll tell you why TS2, what are the geometric properties, and as we do so, you'll see the accident of low dimensions and the size of the Euclidean group comes in very strongly here in this reformulation. And then on the analytic side, if you like, I'll explain a little bit more about this global analysis and how it links into this geometric formulation, and then I'll give a very sketchy details as to what this mean curvature flow. In fact, I'll have to postpone that because in some ways that's the kind of hard technical side of the proof. Okay. So, now, in fact, this reformulation of the conjecture, in fact, for myself personally, was what came first. This geometric construction reformulation of the problem. Really, I had never even heard of the Carathéodory until I kind of had already discovered this relationship between the geometry in R3 and the geometry in TS2, and it was only later discovered that there was this conjecture and have this reformulation, and then the rest of it came from trying to solve it using this global analysis and PDE. Okay, so let me just focus then on this reformulation. Now, it's something of a surprise, but essentially, what this involves is a new representation of the Euclidean group, which has been overlooked, or at least in its totality has been overlooked. Now, let me try and motivate the reformulation in the following manner. So if you take just take a piece of a surface, a convex surface, I'll just draw a piece of it. So you take some surface S, and suppose it has an umbilic point P on it. Doesn't matter. And then look at the oriented normal line to this surface. So these are the oriented normals to the surface to that point. And then if you move out a fixed distance out that surface, what you'll get is often called a parallel surface. So a parallel surface. And of course, you're still normal at each point. Suppose you get point P prime there. So, obviously, with a smooth surface, convex surface, you can just keep on going, whatever distance you want to go out. So, what do we call it? S prime. So, the first thing is that P is an umbilic point if and only if P prime is an umbilic point. P prime is an umbilic point. So, what this is telling us is that somehow being umbilic or not is not really a property of a single surface, but what it is a property of this two-parameter family of lines that are perpendicular to the surface.
The flows don't just get pushed up, do they? Or do they, I
mean, sorry?
These foliations, do they just...
Yes, yeah, exactly. The foliation goes to the foliation, the umbilicity goes to umbilicity. Now, of course, you go out to infinity, it becomes spherical, it gets smaller and smaller, but at each point, as you go out any finite distance. So
what you come to the conclusion is that umbilicity, if we're allowed to use that word, is a property of these two of the normals. It's the property of the two-parameter family, parameter family of normal lines, of oriented normal lines. And it's the way they sit and how they move from point to point that gives you the umbilicity. It's nothing to do with any specific surface in there. Every surface will have corresponding points on the surface will be umbilic or not, depending upon, you know, the way in which these normals sit there. And, in fact, our main idea then is to use this fact to recast the whole problem away from R3 and not to consider it as a problem about R3, but a problem about how the way these oriented lines sit. And the point is that these two parameter family of lines, we consider them as a surface in the set of all lines, in the set of all oriented lines. Okay, so that motivates the following definition and some of the properties we're going to need.
Now, mm-hmm. You need these to be the parameterized lines because you're not comparing points with, you know, that are out at different distances.
I will consider a line as a point in the space of all oriented lines. I'm not choosing a parameterization of the line. Okay, so let me just write down the definition. So if you write L of R3, let's call it, which is the set of all oriented lines in R3. Just look at that set. Okay, so what is that set? Well, there's a couple of different ways you could describe it. In fact, there's many different ways you could describe that set. The simplest way would be just to think of it, you know, Engineering 101, so you have an oriented line, I'll call gamma. How would you describe it? Well, you have its direction vector, we might call u, and then we have its perpendicular distance vector from the origin. Maybe we'll call that v. So, obviously, it's going to be the set of vectors uv in R3 cross R3, six dimensions. With what properties? Well, you want it to be, well, as we've said there, your direction, if u is your direction vector, well then, this you want the length of u to be 1. Let's just normalize it, length of u to be 1. And then on the other hand, what about v? Well, you want u and v to be perpendicular. Right? So that gives you a convenient parameterization of the space of oriented lines. And clearly, it's a four-manifold. Right? Six free parameters with two conditions. Well, six parameters with two conditions gives you a four-manifold. And it's TS2. This is TS2. TS2, the tangent space to the two-sphere. How would you see that? Well, what you can do is you can say move u to the origin. Let's just say we move this unit vector to the origin. It's a unit vector, so it points to something on the sphere. You have v, which is you parallel translate to the end. It's perpendicular here, so it lies in the tangent. Right. So that would be TS2. So what we have here then is this is our natural kind of description of the space of oriented affine lines. Now, not lines through the origin, of course, probably not affine as good, but all lines. They can be anywhere in R3. Okay, so TS2 is a set of all oriented lines, and what we're going to do is we're going to think of a surface in R3, assume it's smooth, it's C1, so you have an oriented normal, then you throw away the surface and all you think of is the set of oriented normal lines, which is a surface in TS2. So from a surface in a three-manifold, we get a surface in a four-manifold. And this is the bigger space that we work in, and this is what gives us the space to resolve this conjecture. Okay, now, at the level of points, I suppose this is it's nice and it's neat. The question is, what about geometrically? How does the Euclidean geometry in R3 have any representation in TS2? And the answer is that it has. So this is a theorem by myself and Wilhelm back in, I guess it's 05.
But
yeah?
How you construct that surface from the original?
Just the oriented normal lines. If you think of every point here has an oriented normal, let's take the closed convex surface. Every point here has an oriented normal line, and each normal line, each oriented line is a point here. Right? So you get a whole sphere's worth of line of lines here, which is a whole sphere in TS2. Right? So we, and there's many different ways that you could describe this, but that's probably the simplest way. Okay, so it's the set that from a surface, a smooth surface.
Line, isn't it at least like 2 to 1 or something? And the line hit the same source twice?
Oh, could, but no, it's oriented, you see.
That's what
the oriented is.
And you're using the convexity to say you're really.
Absolutely, okay. Now, I could talk about this more generally for any surface, and then it won't be an embedded surface here, and I could tell you what the torus looks like and all that, but okay, we're just looking at the simplest case. So a closed
convex. What it means for the surface to be Lagrangian in there?
Okay, well, that's coming. That's coming. Okay, yeah?
Now, if I just gave you a two-parameter family of lines.
Yes.
Then
a surface in TS2.
Yeah, you take a point on a line, you could try to build a surface in R3 out.
Yes, yes.
By always moving in the direction perpendicular to that.
Yes, yes.
How do you know that?
You don't.
You a plane field. How do you know that actually closes up and gives you...
Same question.
Yeah.
Lagrangian. So that's precisely the answer is the previous question. Okay, so if you take a two-parameter family of oriented lines, in general there will be no surface to which these are orthogonal. This will be integrability of the plane field orthogonal to them. Absolutely. Okay, so generically, if I took a surface in TS2, you get a mess of lines in R3, but there's certainly no orthogonal surface to it. But we can measure that. So that all comes into the geometry. This is where our geometry is going to come in, is measuring precisely that. Okay?
Yeah? Radial lines go backwards, down to a point in the middle? Okay,
so in general, your lines may pass through each other, and you get a focal set, and there's all those ideas that you could have. But we're thinking of them as all completely separate. We're thinking of as each line in R3 as a point in TS2, so we don't care whether... I could write down whether two lines are going to intersect or not. I could give you some geometric conditions under which that can happen or not happen. But to be honest, we're not too worried about this. Okay, so yes, they will cross each other and make a mess in here, and you could talk about it from that point of view, but we want to do it much more cleanly. We want to just think of it as sub-manifold here in TS2. That's what we're looking at. And the point of whether you have an orthogonal surface is precisely the extra flexibility we have in TS2 to solve this problem. Right? It's in a bigger space, and we don't care about this Lagrangian condition. We use it at some points, but we don't use it at others. Okay, so let me just... answer a number of those questions all at once. Okay, so there exists a canonical Kähler structure on TS2. Now, by which I mean, of course, a complex structure, a symplectic structure, and a metric, which fit together in the standard compatible way. They're J invariant, the J is parallel with respect to omega, with respect to the connection. Omega is a closed form. It's standard Kähler. Let me just write down, what is the property that we want that to have? The isometry group, the connected component of the isometry group is actually what we want, of the metric is equivalent to the Euclidean group, G Euclidean of R3, which is what? Translations and rotations. So SO3, semi-direct product, R3. Okay, so what this is doing is saying that the Euclidean group, the Euclidean group, of course, sends lines to lines, so it acts on TS2. So you could ask, is there any complex structure, symplectic structure, or metric that's invariant under this action? And the answer is yes, and it's almost unique. But before I say G, the metric G has the following rather curious properties. First of all, it's of signature plus, plus, minus, minus. And this is probably one of the surprising aspects of this whole thing. It's a neutral metric. Well, this is when I use the term neutral Kähler. It's got this signature 2, 2. Okay? Now, I could explain. In my next talk, I'll go through and I'll define the structure and I'll show you how very naturally this 2, 2 comes about because of this isometry group. That's the first thing. It has this signature. What else do we know about this metric? Well, it's conformally flat. It's scalar flat. It's conformally flat and it's scalar flat. But in fact, it's not flat. It's not an Einstein metric. It's not Einstein. So I'm tempted to call this the neutral Euclidean metric, but it's not a flat metric. But it has the same isometry group, right, as the Euclidean group. Okay, now, I suppose, I mean, we discovered this originally when we came across this signature. We were banging our heads and saying, God, we must have made a mistake with the sign. We went back and we tried to, you know, change it to make it into something we're much more familiar with, which is a definite metric. But as it turns out, this is the unique metric on TS2, which is invariant under this grid. Well, almost unique. So this Marcus Salvi subsequently proved that, in fact, this metric... 5 again. One, it's unique. Well, up to addition of a spherical factor, which is not really that. Up to addition of a kind of a spherical factor, you pull up the metric on S2. You can pull it up with the projection, and then you can add it on. So up to addition of a spherical factor. So it's important. So this is one aspect of it. Secondly, if you look at L, the space of oriented lines of or n, this such a metric only exists when n is equal to 3. Okay, so such an what we would call an invariant metric. If you can ask exactly the same questions we asked here, exist for only for n equal to 3. So this is dimensional dependent. So you couldn't expect to have this method work in higher dimensions, or at least if you do, you're not going to get this geometric thing going from the Euclidean into this bigger space. I mean, you can replace all of this, you know, the space of oriented lines is, you know, TS to n minus 1. I mean, you can write it down. All of that goes through as you would expect, but you can't find any invariant metric. There's no metric invariant under the Euclidean group higher dimensional Euclidean spaces. Okay.
Is this the structure? Is this the tangent bundle of
S1? Yes. And the symplectic structure is the pullback of the cotangent bundle of S2 pulled back using the round metric. Okay. So there are many. This is just an accident. And one of the things I said about at the start, it's an accident of low dimension. It's an accident of low dimensional Lie groups that you can express this in many different ways. And I should say we discovered this and this Kähler aspect of it. Of course, I'm using the term Kähler here to allow for an indefinite signature. In some cases, you would Kähler, when people talk about it, normally you assume that the metric G is definite, is a positive definite metric. Here it is not, and it's crucial that it's not, because it turns out that's exactly the flexibility you need to fully capture all the behavior you have here. This metric, anyway, what this is telling you, and I guess this is the original thing, if you look, I guess I found it in 1890s paper by Studi. He had discovered this metric. Of course, he didn't have the complex structure and he didn't have the symplectic structure. He didn't have the modern kind of perspective of Kähler. If you go to mechanics, of course, the symplectic structure on the space of oriented geodesics, if such a manifold, if it's a manifold, always exists. So, if you like, this comes from mechanics. This J was used, in fact, my original exposure to this complex structure was used by Hitchin in the 80s on his paper on monopoles. He used just the complex structure. Now, it was at that time I started looking at it. I took that J and I put it together with the canonical symplectic structure that I had knocking around, and I found this metric of this weird signature. And I was, what's wrong here? This can't be the right thing. But it turns out it was precisely, it's of that signature for a reason. Okay. Now, on the four-manifold side, see, what this kind of suggests, it gives you a natural paradigm on four-manifolds, a geometric paradigm, for neutral metrics. That these are nice neutral metrics. They're not Einstein metrics. They're not flat. They have some, well, in this case, it's Kähler. But in fact, if you look at the set of geodesics, oriented geodesics, of any constant curvature three-manifold, such a metric always exists. So there's it can be generalized in some ways, but it's also very special to dimension 3. Okay, so having discovered this, I guess the idea myself and Wilhelm had was to systematically exploit what we consider to be a fundamental overlooked geometric construction from Euclidean geometry. I mean, who would have ever guessed such a thing would exist? But and as we went through, we discovered then, well, there was this conjecture with regard to umbilic points, and at that point we had realized that we had a way to reformulate this conjecture entirely in terms of this neutral Kähler geometry. So let me give you a kind of a dictionary back and forward between R3 and TS2. Now you'll find I'm going to do this a lot. I'll have things in R3 and I'll have things in TS2, and you can go back and forward geometrically between the two. So let's look at R3. So from R3 to TS2. Now, as I'll go through these in more detail, but just to give the broad steps in the proof, I'll just give the... So here we have an oriented line corresponds to a point in TS2. Okay, so that's our fundamental correspondence. Okay, in fact, you can write this all as a double fibration and as a correspondence space. So subsets here correspond to points here, and subsets here corresponds to points here. In fact, if you take a point here, you could say, well, how would you describe a point in TS2? Well, obviously, you'd think of it as all the lines that pass through that point. Well, all the lines that pass through that point form a sphere. So you get a sphere in TS2. And these spheres in TS2 have some nice properties. They're actually holomorphic. So they're holomorphic with respect to our complex structure, and they're Lagrangian. Now, to anyone who's familiar with kind of Kähler geometry and the modern approach to Kähler geometry, to say a surface is both holomorphic and Lagrangian is completely ridiculous, because, of course, in the definite case, Lagrangian is over here and holomorphic is over here, and they never come together. But here, with this paradigm, you're allowed to have things that are both holomorphic and Lagrangian, but they tend to be degenerate points for the metric. So this is where you end up with degeneracy in the metric, gives you extra flexibility to bring holomorphic and Lagrangian together. So it means that many of the standard results in Kähler geometry don't actually apply here, or at least apply, but you have to introduce more kind of, or it's a richer paradigm. I guess that's the best way to describe it. Okay, so fundamentally, for the Carathéodory conjecture, of course, what we're interested in is to take a surface here and look at its oriented normal lines. Again, an oriented normal lines here would be a surface here. Surface sigma. Now, it may not be embedded in, etc., but we're going in our case, they'll be convex, and it will be. But, going back to your question, this surface is Lagrangian. So, if and only if. So, the symplectic structure tells you precisely when a two-parameter family of oriented lines has an orthogonal surface or not. It has an orthogonal surface if and only if it's Lagrangian. So that's the question, that it's the natural question, and that's the one that... So now we see a surface here corresponds to a Lagrangian surface over here. What about convexity? What about a convex surface? Because, of course, convexity plays a big part here. Convex surface S here, what would that correspond to here? Well, if you think about a convex surface can be parameterized by the direction of its normal... Right? That's one way of defining the Gauss map as invertible. I mean, there's many different ways you could describe this. So a convex surface here, well, this means it's Lagrangian because it's orthogonal to a surface, and more than that, it's a section of the bundle. Because the map that takes TS2 to S2 is the one that takes an oriented line and gives you the direction of the oriented line. So it's a section. So it's a global Lagrangian section. So convex surface in R3, a Lagrangian section in TS2.
How about those spheres that you had before? Were those?
Okay, yes, they're
They're sections of the tangent line.
Yes, they're particularly nice ones. Yes, they're the particularly nice. They're holomorphic and Lagrangian, so they're everywhere umbilic, if you like, in R3, so therefore they're everywhere complex in TS2. So that's the next thing. Where do umbilic points come into this? So if you have P on your surface is umbilic, that means that the oriented normal line, so I always have to start drawing just to give a quick picture of what it is we're talking about, to build up this correspondence space. So we have our picture here in R3, and we have a convex surface, and then we have a point P here, and it's umbilic, and we look at the oriented normal line, which I'll call gamma. What is that? Well, in our picture in TS2, you have, it's a four-manifold, not easy to draw, but let's draw our four axes like that. So there's your TS2, and you have a surface here. I'm not going to draw convex because it's a four-manifold, and I don't really know what that's going to be like. I'll just do schematically. And here, a point gamma. So here you have a surface S. This one will be Lagrangian. And moreover, if this is an umbilic point, it means this point here is a complex point. Complex point. Now, what do I mean by complex point? So a complex point means, you see, your complex structure J is an endomorphism on the tangent space of the whole four-manifold. But in fact, here, at a complex point, it's going to take the tangent space to the surface to itself. That's what I mean by a complex point. It's just that point is complex, means it's an umbilic point. So umbilic points here correspond to complex points here. Complex points here. And then the final step is, what about an index? I mentioned an index earlier. Well, an umbilic index here is a half integer, I of p, and you can then look at this complex point here, and it turns out over in this four-manifold that an isolated complex point has an index as well, a complex index. And it's twice. So this is the complex index. Okay. Twice this... this index here is one-half of the complex index. Right, so this would correspond to... Because this is an integer and this is a half integer. I here is the complex index. So there's a notion of an index of an isolated complex point. It's the degree of the intersection of the zero set and the del bar of the function. Right? There's a standard notion of the index of an isolated complex point.
So a point in R3 corresponds to a sphere in PS2.
Yes.
And it is homomorphic, yes, because if you just took a ball around that point, that's, of course, everything on there is umbilic.
Yes, exactly.
And
there you go.
You're getting the...
It's complete, exactly.
The sphere that corresponds to that.
Yes. And so if you were to say, well, what else? What, are there any other holomorphic Lagrangian surfaces? And the answer is yes. There's spheres and there's planes, and that's it. So spheres and planes are the only holomorphic Lagrangian surfaces. However, what we have here is something more interesting. We have a Lagrangian surface, and it'll have points at which it is complex. Right? And that's exactly the paradigm now that we use to replace the whole classical paradigm of surfaces in
R3. Okay? So the Lagrangian section of the tangent bundle is the symplectic gradient of the function of the sphere.
Absolutely, yes. Perfect. And, yes, okay. And that, okay, so the point is that what the symplectic gradient is the gradient. What's the function in the sphere? It is the support, what is commonly known as the support function for the surface in R3. So I'll write that down maybe next day. Absolutely. It's what's called a support function, which is, okay, I can draw it for you immediately. If you want to take your surface in R3, you take your oriented line here, you take your normal, your perpendicular normal. This distance from here to here is the function whose gradient gives you the complex line.
So did I understand that the tangent bundle, tangent bundle S2, that has complex structure because it's the tangent bundle of the CP1.
Yes.
So that's your complex structure.
Yes.
And the Lagrangian and the symplectic form is its symplectic form.
There's different ways.
You
pulled back by the round metric on S2. I mean, this is one way of writing.
Oh, okay.
You can take the round metric, which you think of as an endomorphism to tangent to cotangent, and pull back the canonical symplectic form. Now, that means, for example, the symplectic form is not just closed, but it's exact. It's globally exact in this particular case, right? And that does have implications. Okay, so yeah.
Can you see the complex structure nicely and
yes,
looking at lines?
Yes, absolutely. Okay, so now you've got to go back to, if I want to look, I've got an oriented line in R3, and I want to look at the tangent space to this oriented line. What is the tangent space to this oriented line? Well, it's the Jacobi fields along the line. Right? So this, the classical way to look at it would be the infinitesimal variations of the line. Okay, so you have your orthogonal Jacobi fields, which is four-dimensional, a linear four-dimensional space, okay, which... Again, I'll explain this a little bit more next time. So you'd have here's your connecting vector. And what is J? Rotation through 90 degrees in an with respect to that oriented line. So it's absolutely, these are canonical and can be described in so many different ways that it's good to see them in different ways for different reasons. Okay, So absolutely, and we can see the metric. Okay, so the two canonical structures, if you like, that you would naturally come up with is the J, as you said, and the Lagrangian. They're the two natural things. And as I say, we came across this metric simply by starting with those two and putting them together and discovering that this is plus plus minus minus. You know, so from that point of view, that's the kind of our particular way in which we've discovered it. On the other hand, you can define G to be kind of an angular momentum. I mean, there are other kind of mechanical interpretations of this metric. Which maybe I will mention next day. All right, so in some ways it is very surprising that this structure, although pieces of it have been around for 100 years, you know, that this kind of more modern view of it as a kind of an alternative to the standard view of Kähler structures, this neutral Kähler structure, that it hasn't been discovered before, and it's the systematic exploitation of this that really we use to solve this conjecture. Okay, so this is our dictionary. We'll use this all the time. In fact, we won't bother using it all the time. We do it once, and then we do everything over here, and then when we get our result, we can go back and get our conclusions in R3. Okay, so this is our formulation at this point. See? Okay. A little bit running over. Okay, so the last bit is to just describe a little bit of the analysis. How do we then prove the Carathéodory conjecture using this...
You would do this Riemann-Hilbert.
That's what I'm talking about.
Oh, that's what you mean, right?
Yes, so let's look at the Riemann-Hilbert. Okay, so as I say, the details I'm going to postpone to the third talk, but at least I'll give you an indication as to why this leads to this... the result for the conjecture. Okay, so the Riemann-Hilbert problem. So if you have, so let's start off. We have a surface in TS2, and the problem we look for is we look for a map that takes a disk and its boundary into TS2 mod sigma. The picture, we're in TS2 now, so we have our sigma, whatever it looks like, and we're looking for a disk F of D, maybe we might call it, and we want F to be holomorphic. Holomorphic. Okay, so this problem is elliptic. So this is an elliptic boundary value problem. Classical elliptic boundary value problem in any four manifold, as long as you have a complex structure. Now, what that means is it has an analytic index. So your analytic index, maybe I'll call it I sub A, is the domain. Okay, so if you have a solution to this problem, you linearize the problem, and then you look at the linearization of it, and the analytic index is the dimension of the kernel of the linearization of the del bar operator minus the co-kernel of, dimension of the co-kernel, I should say, dimension of the co-kernel of the linearization. So this is your analytic index. Now, this analytic index is known to be, it's the Maslov class of TS2 with this boundary condition plus 2. So again, in just a classical setting with nothing else there. So here, this is your Keller-Maslov index. Index here. Okay, so this is standard analysis for the Riemann-Hilbert problem. Okay, so now we have something special in our case. We have many things special in our case. So what we have is the following. So if your surface and your disk, F of D, are graphs, which is of course what we're aiming for. Well, certainly this is a graph and we seek graphs. We look for holomorphic disks that are graphs. Then you have a notion, so you're sitting over your S2, right? So it all projects down onto S2, and you have a region, and then sits up here. And you have a region inside. So here's your disk, and here is your boundary condition. It could be closed or whatever. And in this case, so it's a graph over S2. Well, the Keller-Maslov index of this problem, of TS2, with this boundary condition, is, let me write down exactly the right factor, it's the sum of twice the complex index of the complex points inside the curve. So this is here. So in here, you will have, say, a complex point gamma, for example. You might have or might not have. So what this does is it relates the... Okay, so the Keller-Maslov index, as you go around your curve, this boundary, essentially your tangent plane rotates in the full four manifold. And a measurement of that rotation is this Keller-Maslov index. It measures it. Now, in the very... So this is where your extra... your geometry comes in from your neutral metric. See, your neutral metric allows you to count the complex points inside the curve when you have these graphs. Okay, so if you have no complex points inside here, if it's around over a totally real boundary, well then in fact this is going to be zero. Okay, and so as I said earlier, this is, if you now interpret this all in R3, this is overall umbilic points, four times the index of the umbilic points back on the original surface in R3, if that was a Lagrangian boundary condition. Now, the standard thing that people would do in, I guess, symplectic geometry or in this kind of setting would be to take a Lagrangian boundary condition and try and attach a holomorphic disk. And in the definite case, a Lagrangian boundary condition will never have a complex point on it, so this wouldn't, you know, there is no such relationship. So the neutral signature of the metric comes in here, specifically in giving you this computation of the Maslov index, counting the number of complex points on your Lagrangian boundary condition. Okay, now, let me now give two theorems, which the relationship between these two now will give you the result for the conjecture. Okay. So, I am fluffing over many of the details at this point, but as I will return to them systematically at a later date. So, two theorems. So, let's think in our minds, what is it that we're trying to keep track of? So, in TS2, what would a counterexample to the Carathéodory conjecture look like? Well, it would be a Lagrangian surface with a single complex point. Now, in such a case, it will contain, say over here, a totally real, what I'll call a totally real means has no complex points, a totally real hemisphere. A hemisphere is one that when you project it over S2, it's just a hemisphere. The image of the Gauss map, if you like, is a hemisphere. Okay, so what we prove is that in this situation, if sigma is a totally real hemisphere, totally real Lagrangian hemisphere, then there exists a map, well, a solution of the Riemann-Hilbert problem. I suppose that's the best way to say it. F holomorphic. So you can always attach holomorphic disks to this side here. You can always attach a holomorphic disk on this side of the to a totally real hemisphere. And how do we prove that? We flow to it using mean curvature flow. And proof? Mean curvature flow with boundary. So a boundary version of mean curvature flow. Okay, so that huge amount of technical details, and I'll just pick out a few of them when I talk about this particular aspect of it in the third talk. Okay, so what we're saying is you always have these holomorphic disks that can be attached to these Lagrangian boundary, Lagrangian hemisphere. Why a hemisphere? Well, that gives us the good estimates for mean curvature flow. It's just a purely analytic thing because we need estimates, the maximum principle, maximum principle, maximum principle the whole time. And if it's a hemisphere, we have some natural bounds that we can use to get estimates that gives us long time existence and eventually gives us kind of weak convergence to a holomorphic one. I guess it's also worth pointing out, of course, mean curvature flow looks for maximal or minimal surfaces, which is a second order PDE. The solutions we get are in fact first order solutions of a first order PDE. So there's some subtleties there about how you will go from one to the other. Okay, so to show that the limit is holomorphic rather than just maximal, of course, is part of the problem. Okay, so what's that telling us? That's telling us when we come back here that we have lots of kernel for the del bar operator. The dimension of the kernel here is bigger than zero somehow. On the other hand, notice this is on a totally real hemisphere. There exists no complex points inside that disk, right? Inside the disk bounded by the intersection of these two surfaces. So this is one result. So we have to compare that. Let me write a corollary of that first, and then I'll write down the final theorem, and then we've finished. So the corollary, let me see the way I said it. Okay, so what it says is that any surface sigma containing a totally real hemisphere, totally real Lagrangian hemisphere, must have co-kernel. Why? Because let's trace the argument backwards. This is zero because you're on a totally real hemisphere, and so there's no complex points inside here, so the Maslov class is zero. Come back here. This says that the analytic index must be 2. But if the analytic index is 2, that's not enough because you have the Möbius group acting, and the Möbius group is three-dimensional, so you have to subtract off the Möbius group. And so your analytic index, in this case, you see, your analytic index is minus 1. Right? Well, analytic index minus 3, I guess I should really say, is minus 1. And that means you must have co-kernel somewhere. You must have co-kernel in this. Now, once you have co-kernel...
What you did with this holomorphic disk.
Okay, so it does not enclose, if you like, or cover a complex point.
Yeah.
So therefore, the Maslov index is zero by this.
Just of this disk.
Yes, of that disk, yes. See. And then coming back here, so the analytic index is 2. And then you have to throw this is unparameterized, so you've got the Möbius group, so in fact it's minus 1, right, when you subtract that off. And what that tells you is, well, you must have co-kernel here. You must have co-kernel. Right?
Yeah. Now, if you had 2 complex points, wouldn't you still have a hemisphere that doesn't contain those complex points and that you could use the same argument?
Yes, exactly. So when as soon as you push them into the same hemisphere, you immediately get co-kernel. Yes. That's the conclusion.
But if you've got 2 points, they're always in the same hemisphere.
Well, okay, they can be antipodal. They don't have to... Right. They could be antipodal, which is precisely the rotationally symmetric case, in fact. So, when I say you do have to do some generic perturbations within a Banach space, okay, so I'm saying there's a little bit of fuzz that has to be applied to the argument, but essentially the what we say there is, gets the essence of it. Yeah. Okay, so again, if I formally write down, I would have to write down what spaces we're working in. We'd have to show that they're Banach, and we have to apply Sard-Smale ultimately for the final part. Okay, so finally, the other side of the argument. So this is one side of the argument, is that you have this holomorphic disk you can attach on the side. So for such a thing, it will have co-kernel. On the other hand, in contradiction to that... If sigma has only 1 complex point, then the co-kernel is zero. Co-kernel is zero. Okay, so this comes from a Sard-Smale type argument, and it's because of the proof. Depends upon the size of the Euclidean group, because you can quotient, you can fix a point, and then you get a good model for the Banach space, and then you can apply Sard-Smale. So here comes in the size of the Euclidean group comes in here, and then you apply Sard-Smale. So this is, this is where it's close. In fact, this is the one case where this looks like the standard Kähler case, not the neutral Kähler case, but the definite Kähler case. And so the arguments work precisely when you have 1 point. So that's what's so special about having 1 complex point, is that you have no co-kernel. But over here, we've seen that, in fact, you can't have no co-kernel because you have all these holomorphic disks that you can attach to the other side of it. So it's a kind of a two-type argument. It's a kind of a delicate argument here, and then it's a kind of a sledgehammer on the other side. And between the two of them, you can see that you can't. There's no way that you can close this up to create a single complex point. And then unraveling all our stuff, what that tells us is that there's no way you can do this, that you cannot have a surface with exactly one umbilic point. Okay, so that was my quick summary of the proof, and thank you for listening. Okay, so in fact what you do is you show that you have a good model. If you have a surface with exactly one complex point, you show that there's an open dense neighborhood in CK alpha for which it is Fredholm regular, which means the co-kernel is zero. In the space of Lagrangian boundary conditions for this boundary value problem. Yes. So there is a slide. That's the way. So essentially what I was saying is that if you had one of these things in a neighborhood of it, there would be lots of these surfaces with two umbilic points which would have no co-kernel. But we know they must have co-kernel because we have all these holomorphic disks. And that's the... Right, so you can interpret it as a kind of non-existence, or you can think as you try to clone up, there's this resistance caused by the co-kernel.
Sorry,
Yes.
Let's see. You'll still have co-kernel.
Yes, exactly. You have co-kernel the whole time because on the other side you can always attach these disks. Yes. Yes. You have co-kernel the whole time, so you can't bring them together because if you could bring them together, the co-kernel would have vanished. And, of course, all you really need is that you have a set of solutions for an open kind of dense boundary conditions. You could do it very weakly, but, in fact, you can do it for any totally real hemisphere, Lagrangian hemisphere.
Okay, so the next
Tuesday, I think.
We'd better set the schedule.
It was Tuesday, as for...
Next Tuesday, then next Thursday, then the following Tuesday.
Yeah, that was that. That was what was advertised, yeah.
So talk to a week from today at the same time.
Yes.
And talk next Thursday in the geometry.
So three gadgets and a geometry center.
Okay.
Let's thank Brendan again.
Thank you.